The best thrillers leave us worn out but satisfied. At the end of Love Lies Bleeding, there's only one exhaustion and the vague feeling of having been dragged along a fast ride to nowhere in particular. Adam Neyman of The Ringer is talking about Love Lies Bleeding. Nasty, fierce film noir in theaters right now. I encourage you all to check it out. I liked it more than Adam Neyman. We'll discuss that. Other new movies, Kung Fu Panda 4. Me and Cody all in on Jack Black. Not just because he was Bowser in Super Mario Brothers, but hey, he's playing Poe. And he's back once again to earn your dollars. All you parents out there, you must take your kids to go see a panda. Kung Fu Panda 4. Very small list of movies that by the time they got to 4 were any good. But we'll review it anyways. Plus Four Daughters, which David Sampson told me I had to watch. It's available right now on Netflix. It was nominated for an Academy Award. I didn't watch it because of Sampson. I watched it because it's up for an Oscar. And I still have to watch all these Oscar movies because I'm a completist. So I watched that film as well. Our old movie this week is Win-Win. That's right. Just one more for the people in the back. One more Paul Giamatti movie. I had to give it to you guys. Win-Win is currently available on Hulu. And it's one of his great everyman performances. It's from Tom McCarthy, who, of course, won the Academy Award Best Picture of Spotlight. I'm telling you, it's a fantastic movie. So that's our old movie this week. As far as our wild card is concerned, so I've mentioned before, our bookers from Metal Arc have moved on. So the last gift that Laura Brandt is giving us is next week. And you say to yourself, what's the last guest they're going to get us? Had to be an author. And not just one author, but two. So next week, Alan Silver, I wanted to call him Alain, because it's A-L-A-I-N, but James Ursini, the co-author, referred to him as Alan. It's like, okay, if he's going Alan, I got to go Alan. But you'll hear the interview next week, because Chris and I just taped it. It's called From the Moment They Met, It Was Murder, Double Indemnity, The Rise of Film Noir, which is their new book. So no guests this week. Next week, that'll be our final guest from the bookers of Laura Brandt and Nick Zaccanino, Evan Levy. But what I want to do is I want to go back in the vault, because we recently had Mark Kamon, who, guess what, wrote a book. He was a location manager on The Sopranos. In case you missed it, it was a few weeks ago. In the midst of his book, and I asked him about Barry Sonnenfeld, and he has some good stories about Barry Sonnenfeld, who is an absolute character. So I said, you know what? For the Metal Arc audience, they may not have heard this interview. It's one of my favorite interviews they've ever done. He wrote a hysterical book. So we're keeping the author theme going. Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. This interview was from June 10th of 2020, but I thought it was a laugh riot. I really enjoyed it. So that's going to be our wild card this week. We're going into the vault to play a little Barry Sonnenfeld for all the people out there. The bad news, Panthers beat the Flyers 4-1. Just brutal news right now. We're fighting towards a playoff spot. Flyers 81 points, Capitals 79. Flyers cling to the final spot in the Metro. By my math, 10 games left in the season, the Flyers going to get 92, 93 points, get a playoff spot. You're not concerned. You're trying to get a President's Trophy, which by logic isn't necessarily all that it's cracked up to be.
No, I don't want that, actually. The Panthers lost four in a row before they beat the Flyers, so I was kind of into this little losing streak they were on. But Torts, seven minutes left, down 3-0, pulling the goalie, gets a goal. Gets a goal to make it 3-1. The Panthers end up scoring again, but it was just like, wow, like Torts almost pulled one out of his ass.
Yeah, Torts, very aggressive strategy. 7 minutes left, pulling the goalie. Imagine if he just hit the helmet. We're pulling the rest of the way. I don't care. We need two more goals. Let's go. But yeah, Torts, always a character. Hopefully Philly can get it done, but props to the Panthers. Again, whenever the Flyers, hopefully they make the playoffs, which would be a Cinderella story because no one was expecting it. Whenever they get knocked out, I'm all about the Panthers. You know that. That's my second favorite Eastern Conference team. So hopefully the Cats will get it done. As far as the movies, thankfully, by the way, in case you're looking for last week's episode, thank you so much for all those who support the pod. Go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, and review. No stories about stalkers this week, so that is good news. But yeah, I'm not going to mention where I live anymore. Having said that, Kung Fu Panda 4, the local theater, which I've gone to for the last 5 years, living in New Jersey now, almost 5 years in June, closed recently. I couldn't believe it. I was driving and it just said farewell, like thanks for the memories. I'm like, what? 90 years that movie theater was around.
They named you in the thing. They were like, Adnan, you single-handedly kept us open three extra months. So thank you.
I was on a first name basis with many of the employees. Chris is not kidding. And that was the theater for, again, longtime listeners of Cinephile. No, that's where I lost my wallet. And then 2 months later, retrieved it. I mean, this theater has a really, you know, special place in my heart right down the street, 5 minutes away. So 90 years that theater's been open. It's closed.
Somebody tweeted at me and it was a great question because they talked about how you always bring up exact prices for all these movie theaters that you go to, and they were wondering why, for someone who goes to as many movies as you, are you not part of one of these programs like AMC where you pay this a month and you get it. Feels like people are worried that you're wasting too much money on movie theaters.
Excellent question. So you're absolutely right. So the local AMC, which is at the mall, It's like, you know, 5 miles away. That I could, I definitely have an AMC card, but I don't think I have like an exclusive one or like the upgraded one. Cause I remember the last time I went, I put in my code and I got the points. And I go, when can I start redeeming these? And they're like, oh, you really can't redeem it. I go, what do you mean? I've been using this for years, putting in this code to get some free movie tickets. They go, that's more for like snacks or whatever. I'm like, oh, great. Well, then I'll use the snacks. Like, it's Ramadan right now. But yeah, once I can stop fasting, I'll use this. He's like, well, your point to this is, so I was like, I was getting incensed. I go, I'm going to need to speak to somebody because I'm like, I don't understand. You're telling me years worth of AMC and you're telling me I can't redeem any of this. He's like, unless I upgrade to the membership, which is like $15 more. I'm like, insane. So yes, I need to figure out the AMC situation because there should be some sort of deal where you pay like, I don't know, $50 for the year and you see unlimited movies. My buddy Tyler Korn does that. He does something where it's like unlimited movies because he walks out of more movies than anybody I've ever met in life. And I go, dude, I would say he walks out of like one out of every four movies. I'm like, why? Because he goes, hey, go once a week. If the movie stinks, I don't care. Because it's such a good deal that I'm like, well, I'm really not missing it. I go, but I'm a completist. If I go to a movie, it takes a lot for me to walk out of a theater. I can't even tell you the last time I walked out of a theater. I must have at one point in my life, but when's the last time you walked out of a movie theater?
Bewitched with Will Ferrell.
Of all the movies to apply,
bad.
We're never going to interview Will Ferrell. But if we get Will Ferrell, I'm like, hey, you're an awesome actor. I love you, but man, Bewitched sucked. My buddy Chris walked out of that movie. Will says he gets a good sense of humor. I think he'd laugh. He'd be like, yeah, it wasn't great. Tell your buddy, sorry. I owe him $13.50. Point is, I like to support the local movie theater. So that's why. But now that this local theater's gone, I have two choices. There's a couple other local theaters, which are generally in my area, or I can just go to AMC. So you're right. That tweeter is very correct. I should probably just go to AMC and go, hey, give me the $50 deal and I'll watch unlimited movies and we're good. But before doing that, I wanted to support little theaters a little more. So I went to a different smaller theater I'd never been to before. And I go in there, I'm like, okay, $12.50 for adults, $11.50 for kids. It was like a Sunday afternoon, whatever. I'm like, I like the fact it was early, like 10:30 a.m. Kung Fu Panda. I go, how's your service during the week? She's like, what do you mean? I go, I like to catch matinees during the week. She goes, we don't have matinees. I'm like, what? She's like, we're a very small movie theater here, sir. I'm like, so what do you just have like four screens, you play 7 and 9 o'clock Monday through Friday? It's like, yeah. And then the weekends we get after it. I'm like, wow, that's like banker's hours. I'm like, I really don't like that. I like to see movies at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. I got like a $7 movie right there. So I'm like, I don't know if I'll be back. But she was very nice. And also the other thing I didn't like, the large popcorn, no refill. Like, hang on a second. I got three kids here with me. $7.50 for the popcorn, no refill. It's like, no, I'm like, the other theater I was at, which just closed, was $9, but you get a refill.
That's a cheap popcorn, honestly. $7.50
for a large is pretty cheap. Yeah. You're right. Wasn't as large as the other larges. No refill killed me. $5 slushies, away we go. Kung Fu Panda 4. It is what it is, man. You really want a movie review of this? I'm like, I don't have much to say about it, except I can't believe that there's been four Kung Fu Pandas at this point. I mean, the synopsis is this. After Po is tapped to become the spiritual leader of the Valley of Peace, he needs to find and train a new dragon warrior while a wicked sorceress plans to resummon all the master villains whom Po has vanquished to the spirit realm. That's right. Jack Black back as Po. I mean, acclaimed cast. I couldn't believe some of the actors in this as I'm listening. I go, that can't possibly be Academy Award winner Viola Davis. It is. She plays the chameleon. That can't possibly be Bryan Cranston, who once again is doing ads for Major League Baseball and was on with Mad Dog Russo today on MLB Network. Yep, it's Bryan Cranston.
Paychecking it.
Cranston's like, yeah, I love baseball. Love the Dodgers. I'll take that check. Thank you. Ian McShane. Guy's unbelievable. Deadwood. John Wick 4, he's doing some voice. Seth Rogen, not surprised Seth Rogen's in it. Canadian. Exactly. Unique voice. I'm like, not surprising Seth Rogen's singing. Dustin Hoffman's in the movie. Again, I know he was previously in the Kung Fu Pandas, but I'm shocked. Dustin Hoffman's like, I'm still in. I'll take it. Shifu, I'm in. Awkwafina playing Zhen. It's just a rogue's gallery of actors, but I got to be honest. The movie isn't particularly anything special. The boys enjoyed it. I can't believe if there's a fifth one. I really hope there isn't, because that's going to cost me even more money. But Sarah Michelle Fetters at MovieFreak.com. This is an enjoyably winning continuation of Poe's story. Radhiyan Suman Pillai of Globe and Mail. Kung Fu Panda 4 leans toward the comforting and familiar and eventually hits a sentimental note as it genuflects to what came before, something we didn't see coming.
Does Jack Black sing Hit Me Baby One More Time in this movie?
Yeah. Is that giving you more reason to watch it?
Because I've seen on the internet him singing that song everywhere. And I was just like, this must be in Kung Fu Panda.
It is in Kung Fu Panda 4. Spoiler alert. If you love Britney, it's there. Odie Henderson. Great first name. Always makes you think of Garfield. Odie Henderson, the Boston Globe. I enjoyed the first three adventures of the Dragon Warrior, but the best thing you can do now is give this series a much-needed skadoosh, setting it to rest in the cinematic spirit realm. I'll give it two Maple Leafs. And support your local theaters, despite whatever they may do in terms of large popcorns and no refills. The one I want to talk about, though, is Love Lies Bleeding. Gym manager Lou falls for Jackie, a bodybuilder who is passing through town en route to a competition in Las Vegas. It is co-written by Rose Glass. It's directed by Rose Glass as well. Kristen Stewart is in the movie. She plays Lou, who's running a gym, kind of run down, a little beat up, and all of a sudden falls in love. Bam. Love at first sight when she sees this massive bodybuilder played by Katie O'Brien. And she's pretty jacked. Like, I don't know what your taste is necessarily in women, Chris. If you're like, no, I like a good muscular woman, but like, this is a fit woman. I personally wouldn't be attracted to a woman that I know can just kick my butt. Like, that's not my jam.
That's actually exactly what I'm into.
I'm going to be dominated, beaten up. I'm an absolute masochist. I'm like, okay. But Kristen Stewart sees her and is like, oh my God. Now, she's pretty. She's got, you know, nice eyes, but she's just, Jack, and all she just works it all day. All right, 3 hours, getting big. And the first introduction to Katie O'Brien's Jackie is she's having a little hanky-panky with Dave Franco. That's right, James Franco has been me too. We haven't seen him in years, but his brother's still going. This guy plays an absolute weasel in this movie. He's got the porn star mustache, bad mullet, total skid. Like, this guy is going to be a bad guy, and he absolutely is, because Kristen Stewart, Dave Franco, is her brother-in-law. And that first scene, you see he is cheating on his wife, her sister, with Katie O'Brien. Jackie, how about that? So he's just going to town on her. I'll help you get a job. Okay. So he gets this bodybuilder a job with who? Ed Harris. Ed Harris is having a blast and up playing Lou Sr. Again, horrible salad. Like, just because he's bald, but he's just these horrible hair extensions in the back. Somebody say he looks like a Tales from the Crypt Keeper. He's got, like, you know, his complexion's not great now. The glasses, I'm like, ugh. But you know he's a bad dude. From the first time you meet him, he's playing with bugs. Like, bugs are like his animals. And he's like, okay, why should I give you a job? And he owns a gun range. Like, this is his job. He's like, yep, I'm just surrounded by guns and animals, and I run a gun range. I'm going to hire this bodybuilder to check things out. And I've got my son-in-law working here. I'm like, okay. Because the story quickly makes it apparent that Lou, Kristen Stewart's character, her father, is Ed Harris, and they are estranged. He says he's a bad dude. I don't like him. And even as she's falling in love with Katie O'Brien, they have a couple of rather intense scenes. By the way, this is now back-to-back weeks of lesbian movies. Drive Away Dolls last week, and now Love Lies Bleeding. Both scenes featuring very in-your-face moments. Anyways, after Kristen Stewart finds out, she's like, listen, stay away from my dad. He's a bad guy. He's a thug. He's a criminal, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. Now, the whole story really starts to take flight when Dave Franco continues his abusive ways, beats up her sister, Daisy, played by Anna Baryshnikov. Kristen Stewart's furious. She's very upset, goes to the hospital. Someone needs to pay for this. And then Jackie takes matters into her own hands. At this point, the movie becomes like a really kind of a lean, mean fighting machine. And at times, it's definitely preposterous and over the top, purposefully so. At times, it kind of really leans into the verite style and what it's trying to do. But ultimately, I found it to be a very enjoyable movie. Much more gory than I was expecting. Like, I'm thinking like one of these, you know, 90s pulp thrillers. You know, one of these Tarantinian type movies, fast dialogue, quirky characters, violent. It's definitely extremely violent, but I found it enjoyable. I did not see all the twists and turns coming. I thought it was well plotted. And as a director, I thought Rose Glass has a really unique vision. Again, I was not particularly familiar with her work prior to this movie, but it's got a distinct vision. And if you like these kind of lean, mean fight machine movies, you're going to enjoy it. And again, it's an original story in that it takes this lesbian love story and kind of gives it a real kick in the teeth. James Bertinelli of Real Views. It's a shame that for all the good things Love Lies Bleeding does, the ending is such a complete disaster. I won't give it away, but the ending is definitely over the top. So I see James's point. And Michael Phillips, Chicago Tribune, Stewart, subtle and fierce, and O'Brien, sinewy and fiercer, proved exceptional at hitting two or three notes at once and never obviously. That is Love Lies Bleeding. One more here for you. Before we get to From the Vault and, of course, win-win, a little Giamatti talk. The next one up is Four Daughters. Intense movie. Between light and darkness stands Olfa, a Tunisian woman and the mother of four daughters. One day, her two older daughters disappear. Filmmaker Kauthar Ben-Haniyeh invites professional actresses to fill in their absence. So this is interesting. It's a documentary about a mom and her four daughters, but two of the daughters are missing. So two daughters, two actors are playing the daughters. So you have scenes where they're saying, oh, remember when you were seven, this happened? And they start telling the actor, oh, what happened is this happened. And then they reenact the scene. So it's one of these movies within a movie, which sometimes can be a little bit tough in terms of its construction. I didn't think the storyline always worked, and yet it is impactful once you start seeing what happened to these two missing daughters and what happened to two remaining daughters. And particularly the strength of the movie is the woman playing the mother, Ulfa Hamruni, who's playing herself, because her story, I think, is one of perseverance, and it's also of challenge and resilience. And the story is not without humor. Like, you have to know, watching a story called Four Daughters, why are two of the daughters missing? That's be something dark or disturbing that happened to them. And yet, what I give the filmmaker credit for in doing is able to find the humor, find the light amidst the darkness. Didn't always work for me, but I'll give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. And again, I recommend it because it was nominated for an Academy Award. It was up for the Best Documentary. Very rare to have all 5 Best Documentary nominees all be foreign films, but that was the case this year. Kathryn Benhania, again, Four Daughters is on Netflix. I'll give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. I thought it was unique in its storytelling and genuinely moving, although it wasn't always entrancing for me. All right, one more here for you, and that is Win-Win. That's right, my man Giamatti. A struggling lawyer and volunteer wrestling coach's chicanery comes back to haunt him when the teenage grandson of the client he has double-crossed comes into his life. Great script by Tom McCarthy. Tom McCarthy used to be an actor. He was on The Wire. Then he became a filmmaker, made the station agent. You remember my interview with Patricia Clarkson, how happy she was to talk with the station agent. Wonderful movie. Win-Win is a reunion of Bobby Cannavale, who made his name in the station agent with him. And of course, it's the first time McCarthy worked with Giamatti. When I met Giamatti at the Critics' Choice Awards, the first movie I mentioned was Barney's Version. And he said, yes, nobody asked me about that effing movie. It's great. Of course, you must be Canadian, blah, blah, blah. But I also said, I also love Win-Win. And he laughed. He goes, yeah, nobody asked me about that effing movie. That's a great movie too. So just for PG, we're talking Win-Win. This is one of those stories which is so appealing because it shows people who are good people inherently, yet making bad decisions. And that's always a fascinating construct, is to say, you know, why is a generally good person making a bad decision? And in this case, Giamatti's got one of his everyman characters. Like this is like every man with a capital E. Who else could do this but Paul Giamatti? Struggling, though not overly ambitious lawyer. He's got a nice wife, Amy Ryan. Of course, he's always great in indie movies. He's got 2 daughters, but he's struggling for money. First scene of the movie, you see him running. He slows down for a second. 2 people pass him. He gives a sigh. Win-Win title comes up. Later on, him and Cannavale going for a run. Giamatti stops. He's like, oh my God. He's like, what's happening? He's like, he starts shortening his breath. Cannavale, kind of a comedic scene, throws his phone away. By the way, this was moments before he had asked Giamatti to take a picture of his ass because he was mad at his ex-wife. He goes, I want you. He's like, don't do it. He goes, no, take a picture. He's mooning his ex-wife, loses the phone. Giamatti's having a heart attack / panic attack. It's played for somewhat laughs because it's kind of like a homoerotic scene, the way Cannavale mounts him. And 2 of the runners are like, are you guys okay? Next shot is ambulance. Ambulance leaves away. Cannavale goes, what's going on with you? He's like, it's been happening a few times. What's going on? He's like, what's I'm under a lot of stress. You know, the business isn't doing that well. And, you know, I got the girls and, you know, there's this tree that needs to be taken down in front of my house. It's $6,000. And he's like, geez, Mike, you're going to handle this stuff. He's like, yeah. So this is not based on a true story, but I imagine watching these movies, you see to yourself, how many people can relate to a struggling lawyer who's trying to deal with financial issues? He also happens to be a volunteer wrestling coach. This is where things get a little bit interesting and definitely unique in Tom McCarthy's world, because he figures out a loophole. Burt Young, who was Polly in Rocky, he plays a man who right now is court-appointed judges saying he's struggling with dementia, should he be placed in a home? And Giamatti gets an idea from the secretary. If you say you're going to be his loan sponsor, benefactor, caretaker, you get $1,500 a month. So he tells the lawyer, he goes, don't worry, I'm going to look after him. And the other lawyer's like, how long have you known this guy for? You're going to look after him? He's like, yeah, yeah. He's like, I can do it. No problem. She's like, are you sure, Mike? He's like, yep, I got it. So he takes the check for $1,500, ends up depositing it in his own fund, and puts Burt Young's character in a home, even though his wish is to live in his own home. Follow that? The secretary at one point says to Mike, hey, what's this check for? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to put it in personal account. She's like, are we putting that in the business? Like, we've got some problems right now. This thing is clanging. He's like, no, it's I'm looking after him. It's okay. Similarly, when he tells his wife, I got to go swing by this neighbor's house. I'm just helping him out, checking out. She kind of raises an eyebrow like, are you sure about this? He's like, yeah, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And this is what happens when good people make decisions like this. They feel like they have no other choice. So because he's disheartened, he's using this money and doing it under nefarious means. Now, how does the wrestling stuff come in? So this is where it's interesting. Alex Schaefer shows up one day at Burt Young's house. So when Giamatti goes to check on him, who's this kid? Oh, this is my grandpa. Oh, okay. Well, why is this kid showing up? The kid has run away from his mother, who has been in and out of drug rehab, currently away right now. So when they ask him, Amy Ryan and Giamatti go, why are you doing here? He's like, well, my mom's in rehab. Who's looking after you? Well, it's supposed to be your boyfriend. He's a deadbeat, so whatever. I want to go see my grandpa. Who's looking after my grandpa? Oh, Mike Flaherty says, well, I'm looking after grandpa. Okay, I'm a lawyer. Well, you can hang with me for a little while. So it's really an odd situation. Even Amy Ryan's like, I don't know, but who is this kid? He's like, well, we're just going to look after him a little bit, figure it out. Oddly enough, they enroll him at the high school. And Giamatti happens to be a volunteer wrestling coach, along with a great Jeffrey Tambor, as funny as it gets. And the kid happens to be a wrestler. And Alex Schaefer, who plays the actor, was indeed the New Jersey State High School wrestling champion the year before the film was made, had to quit the sport due to a back injury. But he joins the team, and lo and behold, the guy's great. So all of a sudden, Mike Schaefer is down on his luck, and now things are turning around. He's got the $1,500 a month from looking after Burt Young. He's got this kid who is now helping out the wrestling team. Everything is working along great, right? Until, of course, things are going to start to go bad and start to go south. Tom McCarthy, by the way, co-wrote the movie with his old childhood buddy and wrestling teammate, Joe Taboni. And I'm not sure if you ever did any wrestling, Cody. My eldest son did it for a year. I don't know much about it, but some of the verbiage and stuff, I was like, okay, that sounded kind of familiar. You can tell this is someone who knows a thing or two about high school wrestling. But in terms of it being a sports movie, I wouldn't necessarily categorize it as such. There has not been a lot of wrestling movies, aside from, of course, The Wrestler, which is great, Aronofsky film. But there's one scene which is kind of like a wrestling movie, sports movie scene. The kid is talking to Amy Ryan's character about his frustrations and things with his mom, blah, blah, blah. And she lifts up her pants and it has a JBJ. She's like, what size? He's like, John Bon Jovi. She's like, I'm from Jersey. Like, come on, he's my hero. He's like, oh, God, John Bon Jovi. Here we go. Makes a point, whatever. He confesses the reason why he got kicked off his wrestling team before is because he stole a car. And she's like, what? He's like, so your mom's a drug addict and you stole a car, which is why you got kicked out of high school. He's like, yeah. Having gone through some stuff, it's like, well, you know, you can always overcome the past. You know who'd agree with that? Who? JBJ. And then boom, it goes to Bon Jovi montage, Have a Nice Day, of them doing some wrestling scenes. That's one of the few knocks against the movie. I didn't necessarily care for the always popular sports movie montage. But other than that, I thought it was really smart in that the movie takes some chances where you're not expecting it to go, because you kind of feel the story's going to go this way. The mom's going to show up. Why is my son here? Eventually, people are going to find out what Mike is doing with the grandpa. How is that all going to lead to some sort of reconciliation? But ultimately, I thought it was a smart resolution, and the movie's got a lot of heart, and it features, as always, a reliably brilliant performance by Giamatti, especially once the house of cards falls in. Like, we all know good people who make mistakes. When those mistakes start to come, are you going to be accountable? Are you going to be honest about it? And the way he has to deal with his reckoning is absolutely perfect. The featured school, by the way, New Providence High School in New Jersey, is the alma mater of writer-director Tom McCarthy. And Amy Ryan and Bobby Cannavale have the same birthday 2 years apart. A little more trivia there for you. By the way, Cannavale, he's so excels at these roles of playing the best friend. Like, if you just didn't know Bobby Cannavale and I just see him in a movie, I'm like, this guy's going to play the best friend. Like, he's in, not Iron Man, he's in Ant-Man. He's in Ant-Man. It's like one of those characters. Like, you always see Cannavale, I'm like, yeah, he's going to be the best friend, because he's just always great as the best friend. But ultimately, I thought the movie was really smart and funny. And one of these user reviews, which I don't often read, win-win is a winner. Like enduring friendships, win-win grows and deepens as it unfolds. The characters become more dear, the laughs get louder, the plot thickens. Writer-director Tom McCarthy also wrote and directed one of my all-time favorite movies, The Station Agent, has created a group of characters as strange and wonderful as real people, but with better lines. Paul Giamatti, Amy Ryan are perfect. Newcomer Alex Schaefer, as a troubled teen wrestler, creates a whole new kind of cool, and Bobby Cannavale sparkles in every scene. I would tend to agree with that. Make sure you check out Win Win. It's available right now on Hulu, and it's great. Charlotte O'Sullivan, the London Evening Standard. Win Win is slighter and sappier than it might have been. Still in all, it's a joy. Steve Rose of Guardian, for all its witty observations and the trials of modern manhood, it never strays out of its blinkered suburban comfort zone. And lastly, Mark Lee of Daily Telegraph. This is a great one. Riffs engagingly on the quiet desperation of ordinary, decent folk who find themselves in a fix, who take the wrong road for the right reasons. Win-Win is currently available streaming on Hulu. I give it 4 Maple Leafs. That is our old movie. And again, our new movies, make sure you check out Love Lies Bleeding. Also, Four Daughters is available on Netflix, and Kung Fu Panda currently in theaters. Kung Fu Panda 4. From the Vault, Barry Sonnenfeld, June 10th of 2020. Enjoy. Barry Sonnenfeld's philosophy is regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. The best $29 I spent during this pandemic was buying his book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. It is so funny. Of course, he is the director who has done lots of great films over the years. So much great work now working in television as well. And of course, a great cinematographer on those early Coen Brothers films. Barry, I can't thank you enough for the time. I have so many questions while I was reading the book, so a couple of quick hitters right out of the gate. Why do you think John Peters, in his first meeting with you, told you that he's a premature ejaculator?
You know what? John's a very wacky guy. He used to come to our house on weekends to talk about, this is on Wild Wild West, he was a producer, he would come to our house on an occasional weekend wearing a Speedo and nothing else, and my 4-year-old daughter would say, why did John come visiting us in his panties? So John's an unusual guy. I don't know why he told me that. I guess to impress me.
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to let you know. I mean, he doesn't waste anyone's time. Robert Frank, the photographer who directed the Rolling Stones doc, is the title Cocksucker Blues in honor of Mick Jagger's lips?
I have no idea. You'll have to ask Robert Frank, but I assume so, because it was a documentary about one of the Stones tours that never got released. So I would guess that might have been the name of their tour, actually.
Now we dive into the funniest chapter of the entire book, an actress short, A Cum Shot Behind, which had your wife, Sweetie, convulsing in laughter and did so for me, myself. Ron Jeremy, as you describe him, was the creepiest, hairiest person you'll ever meet. He had an incredibly long penis and a very short torso, which is how he could blow himself. The pungent smell, which you described, Barry, I mean, you did such a great job de-glamorizing the porn industry. Do you realize evangelicals are going to use your book? They're going to use that chapter to say, listen, this is why pornography is bad.
You know what? If they need to do that, go with God, as they say. It was the first chapter I ever wrote. I had no intention of writing this memoir. I just, for fun, more than a decade ago, wrote that chapter, which is based on the true story of when I got out of graduate film school. I bought a used 16-millimeter camera. This is obviously way before video. And my first job was shooting 9 feature-length pornos in 9 days. And it ends with me not being able to get an erection for the next 6 months after I was done with those 9 days of filming. I tell people that if pornos were released with smell-o-vision, it would do away with the entire industry.
The way you paint that picture, it's about as visceral as it gets, really scatological humor. Your father, as you describe him late in your book, once again, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, buy the book, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. Your father, good guy, terrible father. You discovered his condoms for his affairs. He thought that a woman could only conceive during her period, and he let CM the CM, Cousin Mike the child molester, stay with you. His rationale, nothing short of frightening, saying, I thought he was just playing with your penis. I play with my penis and it feels good. Was it therapeutic emotionally to unload all of this on the page?
You know what? The easy answer is to say that writing this book was very cathartic. But truthfully, you know, as you know, since you've read the book is both funny, disgusting, hilarious, and sort of creepy and sad. But I felt all those things all my life. It's kind of why I've been attracted to sort of directing and shooting dark, quirky, unusual movies like A Series of Unfortunate Events, which was a series for Netflix, or Adam's Family, or the Men in Black series. So I think I had come to terms with everything already. I found writing the book really just lots of fun. I never had writer's block. I could sit down and write 30, 40 pages a day. In fact, the first draft of this book was 80% longer. But just like my movies, I like them very short. So I literally cut out 60%, 70% of my first draft. And so I got plenty for a sequel.
I was going to say, I want to read the full draft of the sequel, whatever you're going to plan, because I think you're right about the fact it's both horrifying and funny in the same sense, kind of like a Todd Solondz film, Happiness or Welcome to the Dollhouse. You know, you wrote you wouldn't wish sex with your mom on Hitler. In pics, she looks uncannily like George Washington, Roger Ebert, and Vincent Gardenia's photo double. When shooting When Harry Met Sally, which you were the DP, Billy Crystal said, your mother's a lesbian. You know, how about the fact she said child sex abuse didn't have the same stigma back then as it does now?
Right. You know, both my parents, I'm kind of mean to them throughout the entire book. They weren't good parents. They shouldn't have had any children, although I seem to have gotten through everything just fine. But as I write in the book, near the end of the book, I become I write a chapter about my father's 90th birthday party where I sort of admit that my parents were very good people. They were just terrible parents, but they were truly terrible parents. But you know what? I suspect everyone to some extent has problems with their parents. Most people do. My wife didn't, actually, with her parents. But I have to say they were just terrible parents, but they were good people.
I like the honesty. I think that's what makes the book so great. Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Check it out. Barry, this is unbelievable. Goodfellas is one of my favorite movies of all time. I knew Michael Ballhaus was the DP. I had no idea you shot the scenes of Henry Hill as a kid, and you endured mockery from two of my favorites all time, Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, you know, Michael Ballhaus was a cinematographer. He was Scorsese's cinematographer for a while, and he had to leave. He had an outdate because he was going to shoot Mike Nichols' movie, Postcards from the Edge. And Michael and I shared, we were both DPs, and I shared the same crew with him, the same New York grip and electric and all that. So it made sense when Michael had to leave that they asked me to come in and shoot the last 2 weeks of Goodfellas. And there was only one last night where De Niro was in the movie. The rest of it was all young Henry Hill. And De Niro and Scorsese would sit right in front of the monitor watching the take and talk about how they should change things for the next take and all that stuff. And hopefully my wife will answer this phone. it's my daughter, Chloe. She was FaceTiming me. But I never know if she's FaceTiming. I always think she's calling me. And then at some point in the conversation, she'll say, "Why do you have your phone to your ear? Why am I staring at your ear?" And then I'll realize, oh, it's a FaceTime call. And then she says, "Just how old are you?" Because we enjoy being mean to each other. But in any case, De Niro and Scorsese would whisper to each other and then turn around because I was sitting one row behind them, and they would turn around and look at me and then start laughing hysterically, which is something that's really frightening because I've never seen De Niro or Scorsese, laugh in their lives practically. So De Niro made fun of me when we were done shooting. And the next day I said to Scorsese, "Were you and Bobby like looking at me and laughing at me the whole evening?" And Scorsese said, "Yeah, absolutely. We totally were. We were just making fun of you the whole time. We were just making fun of you." Because that's the way Scorsese talks. And I said, "Can I ask why?" And he literally said, "Well, look at you," which meant you seem so enthusiastic and young. And, I'm very different than Ballhaus, who's a very German gentleman, like wears black every day. You know, on the other hand, I wear white shirts and ties and I'm not distinguished or anything. So it was quite a different experience for them after working with the great Michael Ballhaus to work with young, enthusiastic Barry.
Oh, it's so funny. It's so good. What memories do you have of shooting Goodfellas? Like I said, I know it was only a couple of weeks, but Scorsese obviously loves that roaming, restless camera, always so kinetic, particularly those camera moves in Goodfellas that I remember that first 20 minutes of the movie.
Right. You know, my style is very different. And, Michael lights entire scenes, which allows you to, do those great 360s and all the stuff he did, both in Goodfellas and also The Color of Money. And my style is much more lighting each shot individually and making each shot look good. If you light for 360, you have to light in a very sort of flat way that allows you to have lighting anywhere in the room, kind of. And in fact, this is not in the book, but after that first night of shooting, and I went and watched what Michael's last night so I could duplicate his work, because we have very different styles. So I watched what he was doing so I could not use my style but use Michael's style. And the next morning, after shooting all night, I was woken up by the great Selma Schumacher, who is Scorsese's editor for the last, 40 years. And she said, "What did you do?" And she was screaming at me, and I had just woken up, and I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "The dailies look horrible." And I said, "Well, I don't think they can look horrible. I mean, all I did," she said, "you're not trying to match what Michael did, are you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's exactly what I'm trying to do." And she said, "I don't like anything he shot. Don't duplicate what he did. Make it look better." So that gave me license to not do what Michael would have done the last 2 weeks that I shot. So the stuff of young Henry Hill looks a little different than the stuff that Michael shot with older Henry Hill. But Michael is a great cinematographer. It's just we had very different styles.
We're talking with Barry Sonnenfeld. Call Your Mother is his book, Memoirs of an Erotic Filmmaker. Buy it. You shot the Coen brothers' first few films, Barry. They're so inventive visually. Blood Simple, of course, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. I'm a big fan of Gangs in New York. So when I read the book, the part I laughed out loud is you and the Coen brothers, who did not like Gangs in New York. I mean, I like Dante Ferretti's, production design and the Chinatita Studios, Sandy Powell costumes, etc. But I found the reason you guys didn't like it hilarious. What was the reason that you guys said?
Well, Joe and Ethan didn't actually know the real reason. They just looked at me. We were all at the premiere at the Ziegfeld, and the movie got done, and Ethan said, "Why was that movie so bad?" And I said, "Too much panning." Which, by the way, was Scorsese's thing to do with Ball House, if you look at... Although, I don't think Ball House shot it, right?
No.
Richardson shoot?
Correct. Robert Richardson, yep.
Right. Yeah. But it was still that sort of roaming, panning camera. And I personally, I'm a control freak in life, in directing, in cinematography. I like to tell the audience exactly where to look, and I like to dolly and push in and out or track. I find panning really lazy because it's sort of like saying, I don't know where the camera should be. Maybe it should be here, maybe there. It's just not my style, and I just don't like panning. And in fact, after I left the Coens to become a director, they started to work with a British guy who lit like Michael Bauhaus, in that they would light entire sets instead of individual shots, and the Coens started to pan more. And I remember going to see A Serious Man at their premiere, and this was decades after I was working with them, and I said, "I think this is the best looking movie you've done since Miller's Crossing," which was the last movie I did with them. And Joel said, "Why this one?" And I said, "Very little panning." So panning and me are, it's always about panning. It's not the right way to review movies, but it's a specific way.
Well, I will use that segue to say nobody panned a movie that I think it's my favorite film you directed, and that is Get Shorty. The stories in Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother are amazing. Danny DeVito is going to be the lead. Quentin Tarantino convinces John Travolta to do it. The egos of Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty behind the scenes. My favorite line of the entire movie, which I recite, by the way, all the time, is Gene Hackman, who, of course, is the schlock producer, when he's got his one big script, says, "This is going to be my driving Miss Daisy." Want to know, was that an ad lib or was that the script?
No, that was Gene Hackman is not what you would call an ad libber. No, that was written by Scott Frank. It was not in the book, the Elmore Leonard book, but Scott Frank did a fantastic job of taking Elmore Leonard's book and turning it into a movie script. In fact, until Get Shorty, there had not been a movie based on an Elmore Leonard novel that was any good or had made money until Get Shorty. And I think the problem was that people didn't understand that the way to play with Elmore Leonard's humor is to not acknowledge the comedy and just play the reality of it and let the reality be funny. And I think that the directors hadn't gotten Elmore's brilliant sense of humor. Scott Frank, the writer, did. and did a magnificent job of converting his novel to a screenplay. It's a favorite movie that I directed. I love the experience and love the cast, and just it took me 6 years to get that movie made, so I was very proud that we finally got it made and that it was successful.
I love the whole cast. I mean, obviously, Dennis Farina, sweetie, your wife says, don't worry, you got Farina and Hackman. This movie's going to be hit. She was right.
I know, and I just fell in love with Farina and hired him to be in another movie I directed called Big Trouble, and he's equally brilliant in Big Trouble. And talk about a guy who knows to avoid the comedy to be funny. I mean, Farina was as straight and flat and just delivered the lines without any comedic spin to it, and that's why he's so hilarious in both Big Trouble and Get Shorty. He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
Another wonderful guy you describe in the book is Danny DeVito. You describe him as the most self-confident person you know, and Throw Mama from the Train, one of my favorite movies as a kid. I thought the Hitchcockian odes are so much fun. Strangers in a Train, You Do My Murder, I Do Yours, and Ramsey's Unbelievable.
Right.
You also shot Misery, which again, speaking of horror films, Kathy Bates, that monstrous tormenting of Jimmy Caan. Tell me about those experiences, shooting Throw Mama from the Train and Misery.
Well, Danny and I just loved working with Danny. Just the loveliest, most generous guy. He was just fantastic. In fact, when I was shooting Throw Mama, which was in L.A., Sweetie was back in New York because she was in the middle of a divorce and she couldn't leave and she had children. So Danny and I spent all of our time together. Sweetie was able to come out one weekend, and I told Danny I was going to go to the Ritz-Carlton at the Laguna Niguel with Sweetie for the weekend. And he said, it's horrible. You're going to have a terrible time. You're not going to like it. You shouldn't go. But I went anyway, and we got there, and the bellman took us to our room, Sweetie and me to our room, and 5 minutes later, there's a knock on the door, room service, and there's a bottle of Grand Dame champagne and a huge bowl of caviar, and it says, you know, welcome to the Ritz-Carlton. But it didn't say that it was from Danny. It just said, welcome to the Ritz-Carlton. I said to Sweetie, Danny's nuts. This place is fantastic. They give you caviar, expensive champagne. Then, of course, on Monday, I found out it was Danny sending me that because Rhea, his wife at the time, had told Danny that he shouldn't have told me I would have a bad time. So it's his way of making up for it. But Danny and I got along great. And when I read Get Shorty, I said to Sweetie, read the book and tell me who the lead is. And she read the book and said, well, it's about self-confidence. It's Danny. Because as I said, Danny is the most self-confident person I know for no apparent reason. Danny was just great to work with. I'll tell you one more Danny story. When we finally got the green light to make Get Shorty at MGM, we had this one final meeting. We worked out the budget, which is another funny story in the book. And then Danny and I were both going to the men's room. We opened the door, and there are two urinals straight ahead, the short one and then the taller urinal. And I am facing the shorter urinal, and Danny's next to me facing the taller one. As we are walking towards the urinal, and I don't know what to do. Do I cross in front of Danny and go to the taller urinal, or do I keep walking towards the short one? Because Danny, he is short, but he doesn't play short. You know, he doesn't Kevin Hart his height. So I just kept walking towards the boy's urinal, and I got within 6 inches, and Danny turns to me and says, what are you, a fucking moron? And I go, okay, I get it, and we switch places. But Danny was the best. And who was the other person you were asking about?
I was asking about shooting Misery with Kathy Bates, Jimmy Caan, Rob Reiner movie.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, Rob and I had become good friends because I was his cinematographer on When Harry Met Sally. Sweetie and I introduced him to his wife, Michelle. They got married a month after we did, and we just both celebrated our 30th wedding anniversaries. So when Rob asked me to shoot Misery, he was talking about Bette Midler to play the Kathy Bates role. And I said, well, you could do that, but you should really hire Kathy Bates, who I had seen on in a Broadway a production called Night Mother. And I thought Kathy was fantastic, and I knew her because she was friends with the Coens. So Kathy met Rob. Rob hired her, and Kathy and I loved working together. Every day on the set, we would curse each other out when we saw each other every morning. She thanked me when she won the Golden Globe and for convincing Rob to hire her. And I just loved the experience of that movie. Loved working with Rob. It was hard working with Jimmy Kahn because he's so energetic. He's one of those guys that when you sit with him, his leg is always bouncing up and down. He's just got like way too much energy. And for that guy to have to lay in bed for 84 pages of a script was a nightmare for both of us, I think.
I can only imagine. Couple more, and I'll let you go. Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. I love Michael J. Fox. I had to remind myself, you directed For Love or Money, which I know didn't do well, you know, critically, yeah, commercially. But I just love Michael J. Fox. What was that experience like? This was after you directed Adam's Family.
Right. So after I directed Adam's Family, I was asked to do For Love or Money, and I thought it was slightly like Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, or watch the one with Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, The Apartment?
The Apartment. I thought it was like The Apartment a little bit. I thought it would do better. I'm not sure why it didn't. Michael had just come off of two movies that hadn't done well. That might have been part of it. It might just not have been as good a movie as everyone wanted, but he was a dream to work with. He was really smart. I remember every day he had the same thing for lunch. He would send his assistant out to the Chinese restaurant and get steamed chicken with water chestnuts and snow peas and just put some mustard on it, which was a very dietetic but yet still Chinese food thing to do, which seemed kind of brilliant because my wife and I play a game, which is if you were on a desert island and you could only eat one cuisine the rest of your life for every meal, what it would be. Most people automatically go to Italian, but I'm a Chinese food guy. Must be because of I'm Jewish. I love that Michael found a way to eat Chinese food yet have it be dietetic. And for a while, that was my thing. But I realized I missed the spicy sauces. Yeah.
That's great. Everybody, go buy Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Here's some other stories we didn't get into, but this is why you should read the book. Bob Dylan Gave You the Finger. You were in a class with Spike Lee at NYU. There was a 35-year-old gay Scientologist who you told Dianetics was poorly written. Tough time directing Robin Williams in an RV who was always on, and Cheryl Hines says you're more neurotic than Larry David. I have to close with this last compliment. I listened to you with my friend Jason Horowitz of MTV. It was a great podcast, and you also taught me something about comedy. You were talking about Men in Black and Tommy Lee Jones has to react and not buy the comedy. I'm watching this comedy, Good Boys, which came out last year. Not sure if you saw it. There's one scene where the three kids are in trouble and the guy gets mad at him and he looks at the one kid, goes, "You can suck my dick." He tells the second guy, "You can suck my dick." And then the third kid says, "What am I supposed to do? Just sit here?" And it cuts to a shot of another guy who gives this quizzical look like, "What'd you just say?" And it's exactly what you told Jason Horowitz, which is that comedy is not in the line, it's in the reaction. And now when I'm watching all these comedies going, right, it's a reaction, that's the key shot.
It's always been that way. If you look at Preston Sturges comedies or Howard Hawks comedies like His Girl Friday or, you know, any of those Bringing Up Baby, it's always a reaction shot that gets a laugh. I learned that personally as a cinematographer on When Harry Met Sally. You know, we shot the famous Katz's Deli scene where Meg Ryan is faking an orgasm. And when you watch that movie with an audience, the decibel level, let's say, is at 800, and you're laughing and laughing at Meg, you know, faking the orgasm. And then you cut to Billy Crystal doing nothing, just staring at her. and the decibel level goes from 800 to 1100. And the reason is the reaction shot is the audience's point of view. So the audience gets to say, yes, exactly, it is funny. And that's what I had to convince Tommy Lee Jones, who had never been in a comedy before and tried to be funny. And I kept saying, no, the straight man is always funnier than the comedian. George Burns is funnier than Gracie Allen. You look at any comedy duo, you want one straight man and one comedy guy. And that's the great thing about the dynamics of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones in Men in Black is that once I got Tommy to trust me, and by the way, that wasn't until he saw the finished movie, but I just wouldn't let him be funny. And that's why he's so funny. And the funny thing is, the problem with Tommy is all of our guns were space guns, right? You know, they're the Series 4 deatomizer and the little cricket. So they didn't have squibs. They didn't make any noise. They were just, you know, props that weren't real guns that didn't shoot blanks. So Tommy, growing up around guns, would make the gun sound. And I would have to do take after take where I say, Tommy, don't go pew or bing, because he would literally make the sound of a gun shooting. And Tommy would, I'd go, cut, let's go again. And Tommy would go, what? What's wrong? I go, Tommy, you made the sound of the gun. And he would turn to Will, and Will would shake his head and go, yeah, Tommy, you did. So I probably did, over the course of the 20 weeks of shooting, 300 additional takes. Because even though I got Tommy not to be funny, I never was able to get him not to make the sound of guns going off.
Absolutely priceless. Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of an Erotic Filmmaker. I also love the fact you're a huge sports fan. The Miracle Mets, you're at the Willis Reed game. I hope we get sports back soon. I hope everyone reads your book. Barry, great, great stuff. I can't thank you enough.
Well, what a pleasure. Thanks. Great questions, and thanks for reading the book. I'm very proud of it.
All right, thank you so much to Barry Sonnenfeld from way back. Again, you should read that book. It's hysterical. And coming up next week on Cinephile, Double Indemnity and the Rise of Film Noir by Alan Silver and James Orsini. From the moment they met, it was murder. You got a week to go watch the movie. You can watch it on TCM, and then you can enjoy the interview. And, of course, lots of new movies coming down the pike. My thanks, as always, to Chris Cody and the entire team. Thanks for supporting Cinephile. Go to Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe, rate, and review. And I'll see you at the movies.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop, opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.